Welcome back. Welcome to the Global Research Hour, Hour 2. We will continue talking about a very important part of the world, the Middle East, with a very noted expert on the region. She just spent some time there recently. Phyllis Bennis is my guest. She's the author of numerous books on Iraq, on Palestine, on the U.S., on the U.S. quest for world dominance. She's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the Transnational Institute, and she specializes in Middle East and U.N. issues. She's written a raft of books. Phyllis, I owe you an apology. Apparently, in my promo on the program, I got one of them wrong.
Not a problem.
I'm gonna let you correct it. You got a brand new one just out on Iran in the Crosshairs. Is that right?
Well, actually, Iran in the Crosshairs is a pamphlet that's been out now for several months. The book version, quite a bit longer and more extensive, is at the printer and will be out in about 2 weeks. That one's called Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis, a Primer. And that's also published by Interlink, as my Palestine book is.
My co-host picked up an article you wrote, and on the bottom of it, it listed Iran in the Crosshairs as a title.
Right. That's the title of the Primer, which is out and available now, so that's been out because...
I understand.
And this, the book version is a sort of longer and more extensive and comprehensive.
Well, it's a bit odd because I tried to Google the title of the book, and I could not find a book with that title with your name on it.
That's because it's a pamphlet and not a book.
That's the reason.
And the book has a different title, so it's all very complicated.
Well, we'll get it all squared away, but you do some marvelous work on the Middle East. I don't know of anybody who really spends more time on this and talks about more important things. So there's so much to talk about, and the region is certainly in flux right now with so much going on and the possibility of heaven only knows what might break out. We take a break in about 1 minute, but the most recent article you wrote that I spotted, is it the one on August 21 called Middle East Still at War? Is that your newest?
Yeah, that was actually published a little bit before this, but it was republished in just a couple of days ago. It was first published in July, I guess, that one. That is probably the most recent, yeah.
Well, the title you use, if I have it right, is Middle East Still at War, : U.S. Losing, but when is unclear, and am I right that I pick up some tones of optimism in your article?
Yeah, actually, I'm just realizing that was an earlier one. That was from May. There's a more recent one that was published in July called U.S. Middle East Strategy Under New Pressure, which also has a bit of optimism. I think there are some reasons for optimism, but there's a lot of dangers and certainly no room for either complacency or sitting on our laurels and thinking that we've prevented war in Iran or that we've managed because of the great victory over the weekend of the boats that managed to reach Gaza through the blockade, the Israeli blockade, that somehow we can put that issue off. The crisis that is looming over the region in many different forms remains there. It's still very much a region in crisis. And I think that what's happening is U.S. strategy is really crumbling, but it's not at all sure what is replacing it, and we have to play a role in helping to shape that.
Oh, absolutely. It was glorious that those boats made it through. I think all of the publicity that led up to the delayed departure got them past the Israeli gunboats safely to Gaza.
Absolutely.
But let's take, when we hear the music, they're going to cut us off. Let's take a break, and we'll come back and pick it up.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. Let me mention, I did in the first hour, let me mention that the program, we always thank Republic for airing the program, and the program is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization and the globalresearch.ca website. My co-host, Michelle Chesedowski, the editor, check out the site by all means and the information on it. Phyllis, we published your new article on the site, at least the one we thought was the new one a few days ago. And let me mention one other thing, and we'll jump right back into the topic. Your friends at Al Jazeera say hello, specifically Marcel Hopkins. And it was a great show for me. They invited me to come on Al Jazeera the 1st of October on their Without Borders program. You've probably been on many times. This is all hat for you.
Yeah.
I guess a man by the name of Ahmad Mansour hosts the program. And it's a first for me, so it really is a big thrill. And but again, I mentioned your name, and I imagine you're a regular with them.
I'm on pretty often, yeah.
but I can't do it the way you do it, but the Middle East is a big focus for me. I'm a writer come lately, just over the past few years. I never intended to become one. It just happened by accident in my retirement in my mid-70s now, and let alone host a radio program. It seems very surreal to me.
It's always fun, though.
Well, I've for a very long time, I've been concerned with the state of things and what's going on, and I guess there must have been something inside of me where I felt I just had to let this out, put it down on paper, speak out about it, and what a wonderful way to spend a retirement. And I have no more core topic that I focus on as much as anything than the Middle East, and whether it's Iraq, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Iran, whatever may be going on, and this is what you spend all your time on, and such an important area, such important stuff going on, and such grave threats to world peace. Maybe Iran is heavily in the focus, but your article struck an optimistic note, Phyllis. You went around the region, and you see some hopeful signs. You don't think spring is about to break out necessarily, but maybe a few things are happening. If we get lucky, maybe that's a good way to put it. If we get lucky, maybe we can get a couple of unexpected good things. But nothing is certain, especially in that part of the world.
Nothing is certain. I think what we are seeing is what I mentioned earlier, the failure of the U.S. Strategic goal, which is to prevent countries in the region from negotiating, from talking to, in many cases, each other, and certainly to prevent other countries, most of all those allied with the U.S. or dependent on the U.S., from negotiating or carrying out any strategy other than isolation and war for dealing with those regimes that the U.S. views as, quote, the enemy. Now, the enemy these days is led by Iran in the region. But we're also seeing that kind of isolate them, don't talk to them, don't negotiate, threaten, vis-a-vis not only Iran, but other governments like Syria and other movements like Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon. But what we've been seeing over the last couple of months is a failure of that policy, not just failure in the sense that it doesn't work. That was easy to predict. We know that doesn't work in terms of bringing any version of peace and stability, let alone democracy, to the region. But what has not been working is that these countries and governments that are closely allied with the U.S. are simply saying no to this U.S. strategy. So you see, for example, in Lebanon, there were new negotiations leading to an arrangement in which Hezbollah, which is, of course, the largest opposition party in the parliament, is now part of a government of national unity with essentially a veto over decisions of the government, as the main part of the government would have a veto as well. In Israel, certainly the closest U.S. ally in the region, you have negotiations going on between Israel and Hamas, led by Egypt, which has been sort of a violation, if you will, of the U.S. effort, both by Israel and by Egypt itself. One of the other close U.S. allies suddenly is refusing to abide by the U.S. rule about don't talk to Hamas. They're arranging negotiations for the ceasefire that has been in place now for almost 2 months, largely succeeding. On the other hand, in Iraq, you have the U.S.-backed, occupation-backed government of Iraq itself under enough pressure that it's giving in to the public demand to at least talk about a timeline for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Now, what was agreed to between the U.S. and the Maliki government is, of course, not a timeline. They use this very weaselly language of a time horizon. Very interesting thing. I mean, it's a great weasel word because, of course, the great thing about a horizon is you can always see it, but you can't ever get there. You know, it's one of those great things. It's like a rainbow. It's beautiful to look at, but you can't ever get there. So I think they're hoping, I'm not sure what the Arabic translation of horizon is, but I think they're hoping that it will work both in the U.S. and in Iraq itself to provide an answer to the widening public demand for a real timetable and a real withdrawal of U.S. troops. It isn't real, but the fact that they have to make some gesture towards it is an indication of how the discourse is moving in this direction. So you have, you know, all throughout the region, you have these moves away from the Bush effort to isolate Iran and isolate these other forces. In fact, you even see in the last negotiation process between Iran and the European Union, the U.S. sent a high-level diplomat, William Burns, the Undersecretary of State, to participate in those negotiations. Now, again, it was symbolic participation. It wasn't taken seriously. Condoleezza Rice, immediately following the negotiations, said, well, we don't think Iran answered the questions. We're not going to take this very seriously. But the symbolic presence of William Burns sitting at that table with the Iranian negotiators was not lost on anyone. It's an indication that this effort, this claim that the U.S., because we're a superpower, we can just impose our strategy on everybody else in the region, others are simply saying, you know what? You really can't. It turns out you're not the only power running around, and your strategy is not gaining anything for us, and we don't feel enough either allegiance to, dependence on, or fear of the United States to feel like we have no choice but to go along. So that's all to the good.
And I think you mentioned in your article that the countries are literally going around us and cutting their own deals or making their own arrangements with Iran. It's a lot easier to get along. The U.S. I agree the U.S. policy is an utter failure, and the longer it goes on, the worse it seems to get. In the first hour, Phyllis, we mentioned that Francis Boyle, Professor Francis Boyle is my guest. He mentioned that I think it's the, I don't know how many ships are going. He mentioned, I believe, the Ronald Reagan carrier, a task group, or maybe a portion of it, is heading for the Middle East. I think he said the Arabian Sea, and due there sometime in October, which is not a good sign, but I wonder whether it's bluff or whether it could be for real. My own feeling is that ground zero, or at least heading for ground zero, is more in the Caucasus with a U.S.-Russia confrontation than a U.S.-Iranian confrontation.
Well, there's a lot of ways to read the recent reassertion of Russian influence in the Caucasus in Georgia and South Ossetia. I do think we have to be very cautious in looking at these ship deployments. There have been aircraft carriers and destroyer groups deployed in that part of the world, specifically in the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf, whichever you choose to call it, for years.
Oh, yeah.
And sending the Ronald Reagan, great name, I must say, for an interventionist ship like an aircraft carrier, is not necessarily indication of anything because there's already one there that they're probably planning to replace.
Oh, I agree with you.
So, that may or may not have any significance at all. And I think we do have to be careful not to allow ourselves to be tamping up the militarization claims without a real grounded source. In terms of the whole question of the reassertion of Russian power, I think that is very definitely a new set of issues that U.S. policymakers, ironically, most importantly, Condoleezza Rice, who's supposed to be the great Russian specialist, she was the one who sort of, as a great Russian specialist, missed the fact that the Soviet Union was collapsing and claimed that she was very surprised by it, the same way she was surprised by the election of Hamas in the Palestinian territories. She seems to be surprised a lot these days. But I think that what is important to recognize here is that this was very much an issue where Russia was finally saying, you know, we've been facing this kind of humiliation economically, politically, for quite a long time, and we've sort of had it. We are a major power, and we should be treated as a major power. The U.S. seems to be viewing Russia as a secondary power that can be ordered around, that can be bribed on occasion with privileges, as they put it, like the right to join the so-called Group of Eight, which is one of those illegitimate constructions, diplomatic constructions, that has no basis in international law, should not have any right to make any decisions about any countries other than their own eight territories, but is considered even officially to be a mechanism for discussion and diplomacy. The point of involving Russia initially was not because it was supposed to be a reward or a privilege, but it was recognizing that, that Russia was one of the major powers in the world, and if you're trying to bring together the major powers, leaving out major powers doesn't get you very far. So this attitude that, you know, Russia can join or not join at U.S., on the basis of U.S. decision-making is clearly not getting anywhere. So I think that was one of the messages of the caucuses.
Oh, indeed. It's hard imagining a group of key nations having Canada and leaving Russia out.
Exactly.
We need to take another break. Phyllis, let's do that, and then we'll come back and pick it up again. Steve Lindman, I'm on with Phyllis Bennis. We're talking about the Middle East. Phyllis, I think in one sense it's almost a hopeful sign to, maybe hopeful isn't the right word, but it's interesting that the things that are going on overtly, whether it's task forces heading for the Gulf region or Israeli war games or U.S.-Israeli war games, I think some new ones are planned. I think if there's really a planned strike in the works, why on earth would anybody want to signal it? When Israel took out the Iraqi reactor back, 25 years ago, there wasn't a clue that this would happen. It just happened.
Right. I think that's one of the big indications that Israel is not preparing a unilateral strike against Iran. It's hoping for a green light. It has not gotten a green light from the U.S. And it's very interesting that even in from a number of congressional sources who have traditionally been quite uncritical supporters of Israel, for example, Congressman Gary Ackerman, who introduced Resolution 362 a couple of months ago in the House, which calls for a number of anti-Iranian escalations, including an almost explicit call for a naval blockade. It doesn't use that language, but it calls for U.S. troops, U.S. ships to be forcibly stopping, seizing, and searching Iranian vessels, boats, ships, planes, anything, en route to Iran, on the basis that they could be carrying weapons of mass destruction, any kind of illegal weapons, etc., without any international legitimacy for stopping ships on the high seas, for instance. That's what we used to call piracy. And what's interesting about that is, although initially, very quickly, he got, 200-plus some co-sponsors, a number of those co-sponsors are retreating and saying they are no longer co-sponsors. And more significantly, the House leadership, the Democratic leadership, which has been very reluctant to take any position that could be viewed as critical of Israel or as less than thoroughly supportive of Israel, you might say, they have been willing to put off the entire vote on Resolution 362. They haven't, in the case of Nancy Pelosi, for instance, the Speaker of the House, they haven't themselves completely distanced themselves from the resolution, but they have made sure that it doesn't come to a vote because right now it's not at all clear that it would pass.
Now, it's the closest thing to an overt act of war, and I think the number of co-sponsors topped 250. I looked up Pelosi. I don't believe Pelosi was one of the co-sponsors.
No, she wasn't. But she has not been willing to criticize it. But she has, as I said, she's taken the very important step of making sure it doesn't come to a vote. Now, that's a very important development, and it's very much a reflection of the ongoing pressure of the anti-war movement, and the recognition that the anti-war movement has indeed transformed public opinion, so that to the degree that people know about these things, it does not have public support. And, you know, at the end of the day, people in Congress vote for things that are going to help them get reelected. And if they think something's going to, you know, not be good for their reelection, in most cases, they're not going to vote for it. That's not across the board, of course, but that's a fundamental factor. So, you know, what they count on is that we won't know about it. A lot of things get slipped into other irrelevant legislation, that sort of thing. But this thing was picked up by the anti-war movement, huge mobilizations against it, and we're seeing that change in the discourse, which we've seen for years now, you know, the fact that the anti-war movement has a higher level of success than we ever had during Vietnam, for instance. We have close to 70% of the American people against the war. We never had that during Vietnam. But the challenge has been, and it remains, how to transform that public opinion into public policy change. And that's what we have not yet succeeded at. Right now, with the, it's not yet a defeat, but at least the delay and potential withdrawal of 362, this very dangerous resolution that would essentially authorize acts of war against Iran, we have the beginnings of that transformation of public opinion into public policy.
And the good side is Congress pulled back in the face of very, very intense AIPAC pressure.
AIPAC. AIPAC was certainly part of it, but they weren't the only ones. There were a lot of forces supporting this, and what turned out was that the anti-war voices were stronger. And that's important.
Oh, that's so important. I guess the thing that's always scary and always lurking in the background is if somebody wants to, let us say, manufacture a serious threat and stoke up public fear, then you can turn that 70% on its head and suddenly get a majority going along with doing something.
That's absolutely right. But I think that what we're seeing is enough years of lies that it's going to be harder to do that in the future. It's not to say it could never happen. But that's our job, is to create the kind of educational and agitational and advocacy environment where that becomes much more difficult.
Oh, absolutely. Right now we're kind of in an interregnum period with the conventions beginning and the candidates about to be chosen and the campaign, whether anything would happen. Well, something could happen during the campaign. The month of October always seems to have a particular frightening connotation to it.
That's true, and there's also the possibility of that 2 months or so after the elections, Bush will still be in power, lame duck or not. So we do have to keep up our guard. We can't afford to relax.
Oh, absolutely. Let's take another break, and we'll come back in the second half of the program.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Phyllis Bennis. The Middle East is the focus. Phyllis, let's come back to Israel for a second. I guess just like we're in election or campaign and election mode, they're going through a little bit of transition themselves. Olmert apparently is on the way out, and there'll be a new prime minister. Does it look like, I guess, Foreign Affairs Secretary Livni will be the replacement, or does it look like somebody else?
Well, it's not at all clear. What will likely happen is that the foreign minister, Tzipi Livni, will become the new nominee of the Kadima party, the same party as the current prime minister, Ehud Olmert. But if elections were held today, it's not at all clear that Kadima would win. She would be bested at the moment by Benjamin Netanyahu, the far-right candidate from the Likud party, who has been a perennial candidate for prime minister and, of course, was prime minister from 96 to 98. He's running essentially on a position of stop the negotiations. Let's not pretend that we're going to share either power or land with the Palestinians, and a much harsher militarized vision. It's a vision actually quite close to that of Shaul Mofaz, who's the other candidate in the within Kadima, who's challenging Livni for the top seat in that party. It's not likely that he would beat her, that he would win, but it's an indication that in general, politics in Israel, within Israel, continues to move to the right.
They're all pretty hawkish, and I guess maybe one description of Netanyahu might be to call him an Israeli John McCain.
Well, I mean, you could call him many things, that's certainly one. But he, of course, it was his campaign in 1996, his campaign for prime minister that led to the creation of a paper that was called Making a Clean Break, Defending the Realm, that was crafted by a number of the same American neocons who had been involved in the crafting of the Project for the New American Century. And it essentially called for a very similar outline for an Israeli regional role in the Middle East, similar to the kind of American global role that they called for in the PNAC paper, Project for the New American Century. It was a lot of the same people who wrote it for him at his request as a election manifesto, it was on that basis that he won the 1996 election and tried to implement much of that, which essentially called for announcing an end to negotiations with the Palestinians, ending negotiations with the Syrians, if any were in existence. They have been restarted now, but he would end them, and essentially telling all the Arab governments and Arab forces that from now on Israel would deal with them on a military basis rather than on a diplomatic basis. So it's a very dangerous escalation of the call for militarizing the entire region that Netanyahu stands for, and it's a serious reality that right now in Israel that he remains the most popular figure among those running for prime minister. That now, as we all know, politics in Israel is very, very volatile, even more volatile than here. So the fact that he's ahead today means nothing about who will be where tomorrow, certainly not by the middle of or end of September when these elections are likely to be held. So it's certainly not a guarantee that he's going to win this election, but it's a sobering reality that politics in Israel has moved so far to the right that Ariel Sharon, who remains in a coma over these last 2 years and who is the mentor, if you will, and political sponsor of Ehud Olmert, who without moving at all from his long-standing anti-Palestinian pro-settlement position, now represents very much a centrist position within Israeli politics.
What I thought to believe, the thought that's on my mind is that we could be going through an interregnum period in Israel. There are signs of at least a bit of negotiations, but when Olmert is out and a new prime minister is in, it could be back to business as usual, just as tough and nasty as it has been.
Well, it's already continuing business as usual. I mean, the reality of business, meaning the expansion of settlements, the consolidation of more and more checkpoints in complete violation of UN resolutions, the refusal even to close down the so-called outposts, which are the small settlements that Israel acknowledges are illegal. Most of them they don't acknowledge. Of course, in fact, all the settlements are illegal. They're all in violation of the Geneva Conventions, including the large city-sized settlements, which the U.S. has agreed with Israel will definitely remain in Israeli hands after any peace deal. So that is continuing. Business as usual continues. The new negotiations that are allegedly underway today, Condoleezza Rice went off to the region yesterday and arrived today, they've already announced that there is no expectation that the so-called goal of the Bush administration of finding a solution by the end of the Bush term, at the end of this year, that's now off the agenda, and what they're hoping for instead is a simply a move to put forward a framework which could then be worked on later by the new administration. Now, if you think back, we've had frameworks. That's what the Oslo plan was all about. It was a framework. The Madrid plan was a framework. These are all frameworks. The so-called roadmap to peace, the role of the so-called quartet, all of these things were about frameworks. What none of them were about was power, was changing the power dynamics that maintains Israel as the, not just dominant, but as the occupying power with all the support of the U.S. and the Europeans, versus the Palestinians, who are understood to be negotiating over only 22% of their historic territory, and within that 22%, they are now being asked to give up anywhere from 15 to 40%. The most recent United Nations report, for instance, indicated that if you look just today, forgetting about what may be on the negotiating table, but if you look at the Palestinian territories today, just in the West Bank, the combined territory that would include all of the settlements, the land claimed by the settlements for future expansion, the roads, bridges, and tunnels, which are controlled solely by Israel, the 10 to 15% of the land that has been taken for construction of the apartheid wall, the so-called separation barrier that Israel has built throughout the occupied West Bank, not on the border between the West Bank and Israel, but within the West Bank, stealing land all the way, and the Israeli declared military zones, which include, for example, the entire Jordan Valley, and the Israeli declared nature reserves, you get a total of 40% of the land, leaving only 60% of that 22%, which is available for Palestinian use. Fully 40% of the land of the West Bank is now not available for Palestinian residential, commercial, agricultural, or recreational use.
And most important along with it is Israel takes the choicest lands and leaves the worst parts for the Palestinians.
And most important of all is the water. If you look at
the
route of the apartheid wall, it tracks almost exactly the line of aquifers through the West Bank hills, and in every occasion, it ensures that the aquifer is on the west or Israeli side of the wall itself.
And water, of course, is so important in that part of the world. And you make the point in the article that we refer to at the top of the program that in any negotiations Israel is having now or might have in the future with Syria, they are simply not going to give up their rights to the water that they want.
Right. Water has been very much at the root of Israeli occupation policies. It was the basis, control of the Litani River was the basis of the occupation of South Lebanon. And now the only real stumbling block that remains, since Syria has given up essentially everything else, in the negotiations between Israel and Syria, is the question of control over the Sea of Galilee. The Israeli position is that rather than sharing it, since it would be on the Israeli-Syrian border, there's a mechanism, a long-standing mechanism in international law. When that's the case, you divide access to water. You have equal access to water by the two countries based on their coastlines of the water source. But the Israeli position is Syria should have no access, no direct access to the water of the Sea of Galilee. So the question of control of water remains very much at the heart of Israeli strategy.
I guess Israel negotiates the way we do, Phyllis. They demand, and if the other side doesn't go along, then they're the bad guy. They're the obstructionist. But it's a one-way deal that would benefit Israel. I didn't get to it in the first hour with Francis Boyle, but back in 1992, he wrote an alternative to Oslo. And it was terrific. I reviewed one of his books, and I covered it in my review. And he pointed out all the pitfalls, legal and otherwise. Mm-hmm. And the Palestinian leadership, he pointed out, initially went along with this. And then they reneged, at least at the top, Arafat and others around him, when they were in Tunis. And they went along. They knew the pitfalls, and they accepted it anyway. But had they gone along with what Boyle had recommended for them when he was the legal advisor, Or possibly something better would have happened. It's hard to really know. Israel might have contrived some other way to get what they wanted. But instead they accepted a terrible deal and everything that's happened since then, 15 years later.
Right, and we still don't know. Right now the Palestinian leadership has no strategy, either for their own negotiations, for the role of the Palestinian population, who are moving to a number of incredibly creative, advanced versions of nonviolent resistance that we're seeing in cities and towns across the West Bank and Gaza, not because of a strategy developed by the Palestinian leadership, but in spite of the lack of strategy. And similarly, in terms of the global movement for Palestinian rights, it's based on international law demanding a role for the United Nations rather than domination of the UN. A role for civil society because governments have not played the role that international law says they should. And that movement as well is developing really outside any connection to the Palestinian Authority. Both parts of the Palestinian Authority, the Fatah-led authority in the West Bank or the Hamas-led authority in Gaza, civil society is really emerging separately. And of course, the unfortunate part of that, it's one of the ways in which the Palestinian movement, I think, has been weakened by the fact that it is not the kind of movement we saw against apartheid in South Africa, where the South African leadership, the ANC, had a full strategy that involved both a diplomatic strategy, a strategy for people on the ground, a mass mobilization strategy, a very small role for armed struggle, primarily symbolic, and a huge role for international solidarity. But it was all based on a strategy crafted by a leadership that was recognized not only by its own population, but internationally as legitimate, strategic, principled, in a way that unfortunately the Palestinian leadership is not.
And they were unified, and unfortunately unified. Israel and Washington has succeeded in splitting the Palestinians in two groups.
Well, more than two, but two big ones.
Legitimate elected government, the Hamas government, now called a foreign terrorist organization, and a legitimate elected government, and Abbas leading the Palestinian Authority from the West Bank. And I wonder how serious they are in having any kind of negotiations together. I guess some of that is going on, but
there are negotiations for reunification going on under the auspices of Qatar. How significant those efforts are, I don't know. They haven't succeeded yet, but there have been some interesting recent signs that the possibility of a unified government may be closer than before.
Well, that would be very interesting if it happens. When is the next election to elect a new Palestinian president?
That's a good question, actually. I think it's around the end of 2010.
Oh, my goodness.
No, 2009. It should be next year.
So it's got a ways to go.
Well, the end of next year, I think, yeah.
Unless there's a call for an earlier election, probably won't happen.
Probably not.
And then the Gaza siege, Phyllis, something that, of course, gets no coverage in the news here.
Well, I have gotten some, actually. The breaking of the siege of Gaza by the two ships, the Free Gaza and the Liberty, named, of course, for the U.S. Navy ship that was attacked by Israel 25 years ago, did get quite a bit of coverage, a huge amount in the rest of the world, including in Europe. Not too much here, but some in the mainstream press.
But it fades very quickly.
Sorry,
It comes and it disappears very quickly.
Yes.
It doesn't stick around in the news very long.
That's true, and of course the question of the U.S. role remains primary in maintaining the siege of Gaza. This is something that Israel wanted. The U.S. went along with it, and said that we will essentially demand of our allies around the world that everybody accept that the entire population of Gaza, more than 1.5 million people, more than half of them under the age of 15, should be the victims of a punishment designed to punish the Hamas, the elected, as you said, Hamas government. It's ostensibly designed to persuade the population to vote out the Hamas government. And well, we know how well that works. It was the same theory that was imposed to justify the U.S. sanctions against Iraq. We're not punishing the population. We're only punishing Saddam Hussein, who, of course, did fine during the sanctions years. It was the 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of five who died as a result of U.S.-imposed sanctions. Very similar to this situation, which is why the work of organizations like the U.S. Campaign to End Israeli Occupation, a big coalition of more than 250 organizations around the country, big, you know, huge organizations all the way to small solidarity groups and others working in small areas, are united in keeping the focus on the role of the U.S., the role of U.S. policy in either supporting or preventing the consolidation of the U.S. occupation and the U.S. apartheid policies. I would urge listeners to go to the website of the U.S. campaign. It's an easy one to remember, endtheoccupation.org, and take a look at some of the resources that are available there. Fact sheets, a lot of information on the apartheid framework and why it applies to the Israeli-Palestinian situation, questions of international law and the role of the United States in violating international law. So I think that particularly for those of your listeners who are in the U.S., keeping the focus on U.S. policy remains very much the centerpiece of our work.
Oh, absolutely. The U.S. The U.S. is the key to the whole thing. And I've been convinced, Phyllis, from the earliest Bush administration so-called peace negotiations, the real goal has been obstructionism, and everything else is just a mirage. This is an administration dedicated not to diplomacy but to conflict, and they just want to keep stoking the conflict in whatever parts of the world that are of key interest to them. And the Middle East is certainly one of those parts. And, of course, the strong bond with Israel, stronger than ever under George Bush. Let's take a break. Welcome back to the final segment. Phyllis, we just have a few minutes left. Let's talk about your new book and how listeners can get information about it. And when will it be out again, in another month or so?
No, less than that, actually. It's at the printer right now. It's supposed to be in the publisher's office, which is in Massachusetts, in about 10 days. So people can order it now, and it'll be shipped as soon as it comes out. It's small and not very expensive. It's $10. It's called Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis, a Primer. And it's from Interlink Books. And you can order it right on their website, which is interlinkbooks, all one word, .com.
Well,
and if you order a few, you can get it for less, actually.
I've read about five of your books, and I think at least a few of them were published by Interlink. So
right.
I think I know how to find the book. Interlink, very simple. Interlink book, and you can find it there, and it should be out. I guess Interlink is taking orders for it right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for people who are interested, we've been talking earlier, I don't think the threat of possible U.S. attack on Iran is over. It may be a little less than it was a few weeks ago, but it's still very much with us. This is a book with both sort of history of U.S.-Iran relations and what the threat is about, what we can do about it. And it's done in very sort of basic, frequently asked question or FAQ format. So the kinds of questions that people have who are looking at Iran and saying, you know, there's something wrong here, but I'm not quite sure what it is. This is a book for you.
And this has been going on for nearly 30 years now.
Indeed. This is not a new issue.
Oh,
but it's a newly dangerous one, I would say.
Oh, it sure is dangerous. Correct me if I'm wrong, and we barely have any time to talk about this. But my understanding, right or wrong, was that at the very beginning, when Ayatollah Khomeini took over Iran in '79, we were very hopeful that we could have a very good relationship with him, and we would just sail along, and there'd be no problem at all.
Well, that was the position of some Iran watchers in the State Department and elsewhere. I don't think it lasted very long. The hostility level escalated quite quickly, although the U.S. did, of course, provide arms and cash to Iran during the Iran-Iraq war when the U.S. was primarily supporting Saddam Hussein in Iraq, but it was also supporting Iran a little bit through the Iran-Contra scandal. That was a way of getting more arms to Iran. So the U.S. has had a long-standing interest in suppressing both the countries in the region that could emerge as the regional powers. Those historically were only Iran and Iraq. those are the only three countries, the only two countries in the region with the three requirements to be regional powers: money from oil, size of population and land, and water, sufficient water of their own. That, you need all three to be a regional power, and only Iran and Iraq had them. With Iraq now occupied and destroyed largely, Iran remains the only country in the region with those capacities, and that's a big part of the reason why the U.S. has its eye on it.
And very definitely Israel absolutely wants Iran removed as a rival.
Indeed.
Not because it fears Iran is going to attack Israel, but they're a rival. Israel wants to be the regional hegemon, and Iran stands in the way, so you get rid of your competition.
Right.
Oh, dear. Well, this hour has gone by. They're going to strike up a band in a minute or so, Phyllis. It's a critically important part of the world, and you spend all your time on it, and never a dull moment wondering what will happen next. I'm very concerned about, no matter who is elected in November, that this thing is going to go on, and we're going to be just as worried about it in 2009 as we are now.
Well, that's the goal of the anti-war movement, is to make sure that it does change. The candidates aren't going to do it on their own. It takes us keeping the pressure on.
Well, there's no question whatever, with people like you in the vanguard and me kind of a little bit in the background, and many, many tens of thousands around the country and the world. This is the way you beat the thing, and you get the policies that you want.
Absolutely.
Phyllis, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful hour, and you got to come back and we'll do it again.
I look forward to it.
Thanks, Phyllis.
Thank you.
Men, are you your